Hey, welcome to Your Turn. Mike Causey, delighted to have you with us. And today is a red letter day indeed. My guest is Tammy Flanagan. She is a benefits expert known throughout the federal community, columnist for Government Executive Magazine, and she works for the National Institutes of Transition Planning. And all you have to do is mention that Tammy is going to be on the show, and boom, it blew up. We have a stack of emails here that we'll never be able to answer on the show today. So, Tammy, I'm going to go directly to it. Lauren Larson, our producer, and I were talking about when you're on the show, we can introduce you and then leave the room and come back in an hour. So
just go through the stack of questions.
Thank you. And the traffic I know is horrendous out there. Thank you for that. Here's one from Joe in Buffalo, New York. My wife and I are currently working in retirement eligible feds under CSRS. We've had a family plan for the past 25 years. Now that the children are beginning to age out, he's talking about he and his wife getting two self-only plans, which would be slightly cheaper than a family plan. And also, he wants to know about her eligibility under the five-year rule.
Yeah, this is a good question because I get this a lot from dual federal couples where husband and wife are both federal employees, and they're at that age where their kids have aged out. So now they can have the choice of doing two single plans versus one self and family, and in most cases, that's going to be cheaper. So the concern here is that if they're getting near retirement, do they both have to have it in their name for 5 years? And the good news is the answer is no.
Okay.
The coverage.
If they've had a family plan.
Yeah, if you had a family plan, that counts towards your coverage just like anything else. And in another year, you'll be able to do a self plus one if you don't have a federal spouse.
Yeah, good deal.
So that's
coming. And you know, Walton Francis, who does a consumer checkbook, he always points out, too, before you jump from family to two singles to save premiums, consider the catastrophic thing.
And yeah, consider your out-of-pocket expenses.
If you're both in a car wreck, you know, at the same time, your catastrophic costs are going to be, you'll each have to satisfy it under a self-only plan.
Yeah, if I remember right, I think Blue Cross, it's $5,000 a person if you're in self-only and $6,000 or $7,000 for a family. So as you said, if it's two self-only plans, you may end up $10,000 out of
absolutely,
pocket.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's penny wise and pound foolish. Be very careful with
exactly.
that. Good answer. Here's one from Dan, and he works on Broadway. How cool is that? I'll be 62 in March with 13.9 years of service, FERS, and 950 hours of convertible sick leave. Cannot wait to leave, but I'm considering delaying till July 2015. It would be his 14th year, or year-end 12/31/15 for maximized annual leave balance. Does it really make much of a difference? The pressure of the job is just too much. Another good one, you know.
Yeah, well, I think the last sentence said it all. You know, if the pressure of the job is too much, you know, you can't say enough about, you know, making a change in your life, the sooner the better. And if you're only looking at another 6 months of service between July and December, and that's your main concern, I would say go out July. I don't know that I would do it July 7th. I'd probably do it June 30th or maybe July 31st. The only real benefit to waiting till the end of the year is if he really does want to cash in a whole year's worth of unused annual leave, because, you know, he can carry over the 240. Well, he wouldn't maybe not even have 240 because he's only got 13 years of service. But if he has saved up his leave and saves it up that last year, that would eliminate the use or lose situation and also allow him to cash in maximum leave. But I think this guy should probably go June 30th.
Okay. Lorraine here says, Tammy, I'm planning on retiring December 30th, 2015. I am a FERS employee. Is this the best time to retire?
I don't know.
Yeah. Could be.
Yeah. Now looking at the calendar for, let's see, we're looking at
2015,
next year. Okay. Got my calendars with me. Mm-hmm. So next year, December 30th is a Wednesday, and December 31st is New Year's Eve. So I would think that most people aren't going to be doing a whole heck of a lot of work on New Year's Eve day. So I would go ahead and make it December 31st, get paid for that last day. Your retirement will start the next day. So yeah, if you chose between the 30th and 31st, I'd pick the 31st.
Okay. So this one from Doug at Social Security says, Tammy posted two case studies for phased retirees, a 66-year-old FERS employee and a 56-year-old CSR employees, but did not include one for a younger FERS employee. There are two issues with a 56-year-old employee using phased retirement. And then he goes on to talk about the legs of income for the different people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm not sure how much younger he was talking about, because you can only go out once the agencies make this available, I should say. You can only retire under phased retirement if you are eligible to retire. So for a FERS employee, that would mean somebody who's at least 56 or at their MRA, their minimum retirement age. So for some employees, that might even be 57. And you have to have at least 30 years of service or be 60 with at least 20 years. And that's the minimum requirement. So you couldn't really be any younger than 56 right now to take phased retirement. As far as taking money out of the TSP, yes, you can withdraw that without penalty at 56. So if you wanted to retire fully, you know, you can have access to your thrift. If you want to go into phased retirement, you're still an employee, so you wouldn't be able to withdraw from your thrift. But if you really needed the money, I suppose you could take a loan. So it's something you really have to, and he's right, you have to look at all three legs. It's not just the FERS benefit. It's, you know, your entitlement to Social Security or the FERS supplement. It's your entitlement to the investment income that you've put aside. So it really does. I've heard somebody at OPM say that this is the biggest change since 1920 mm-hmm. when it comes to retirement, because phased retirement really is a complicated issue when you break it down.
The OPM's gotten so much flack for taking its time with this, but this is, as you said, the devil's in the details. Yeah. And if this is the biggest change since 1920 when they instituted the program, then they're not kidding. Here's one. This is a good one to get off the table, because maybe a statement, and then I'll ask you the question. In order to carry federal health insurance into retirement, an individual must be enrolled in an A plan, any of the FEHBP plans, for 5 years prior to retirement. There are exceptions, rare exceptions, but so if you don't have it, get it. Get a low-cost policy, any one of them, pick it. What you're doing is you're buying insurance so that someday you can have health insurance for you and a spouse. The private sector plan may not be very good in retirement. That said, here's a bank examiner here in D.C. She says, are you aware of any exceptions made by the Merit Systems Protection Board for the waiver of the five-year vesting requirement for former employees? I resigned from federal service in 76, not understanding the ramifications of being 3 days short of the five-year requirement, and I returned a few years later. My answer to her was, there may have been exceptions, but not many.
Yeah, well, let's see. She says she had less than 5 years when she left in the 70s, and it sounds like she came back. She returned in 2011. So the key is, if you got to have that last 5 years of service under FEHB. So if you came back for less than 5 years, they can go back to your first appointment, even if it was in the 70s, and count that as part of the 5 years. The time you're gone from the government doesn't count against you. So it can be a break in service. It can be somebody who had 4 years back in the 70s, another 4 years now, and we can count, you know, the fifth year from that time when you were gone. So I know it's a kind of a unique question, but she may not be in as much trouble as she thinks.
Okay, and the five-year rule is a very important thing for people to be aware of.
But if to understand it, too.
If you're piggybacking on your private sector spouses, be careful.
Right.
Here's one from Phil. I'm a FERS Fed, and I plan to retire at the end of this year, which is a better date, easy enough, December 31, 2014, or January 8, 2015. And I know the answer from looking at your cheat sheet. It's actually, January the 10th?
Well, January the 10th is the end of the leave year, so that would be the last date to pick for retirement if you're trying, and this is mainly for people who are trying to cash in a bunch of leave, you know, more than 240. But with that said, I would say it's going to depend on how much service this employee has, and I don't think they say. Because if they only have 10 years or 15 years of service, I would say go ahead and push it to January 10th, because you're going to get 7 days of pay, you're going to get another leave accrual. You will lose your January 1st benefit, though. So you have, that's a trade-off. So if you went out December 31st, you'd get the January retirement check, but you'd miss out on the last leave accrual and 7 days of pay. So which one's more?
Yeah.
You know, do a little calculation and figure out which one you're giving up less.
Yeah. Okay, good. Here's one from Ken in Yorktown, Virginia. It says, concerns the FEHBP, the health program, and Medicare. Background, I'm a two-year FERS retiree from the Postal Service, turned 65 March next year. My wife's a two-year public school retiree in the Virginia system, will turn 65 next year. We both receive Social Security, have long-term health care insurance, a healthy TSP, which was not been touched until required. Homeowners in good health, no debts, no children were covered by standard family Blue Cross Blue Shield. We'd like to keep the Blue Cross option indefinitely when we start on Medicare A. Is there any automatic changes or risks to our current program if we do not select Medicare Part B?
Yeah, there are. Everybody doesn't want to sign up for Medicare Part B because you have to pay a premium. And when you're in good health, you know, just paying one premium for health insurance can seem like too much. And especially, you know, Blue Cross next year is going to go up a bit. So you're going to pay a higher premium for it next year at the tune of $18 a month for family coverage or $7 a month for single coverage as increased premium. So I can understand not wanting to pay an extra premium for Medicare. But you have to think, and I always say in my seminars, think like you're 85. And by the time most of us are 85, we're going to have one, if not two, chronic illnesses that we're treating. And those out-of-pocket expenses, even with Blue Cross, even with a good quality plan, any federal plan, you're going to have out-of-pocket deductible, you're going to have a co-insurance. If you don't go to preferred providers, you might pay a higher co-insurance. And that can add up to way more than $105 a month for Medicare Part B.
And if you don't take Part B at the beginning and then opt in later on, it costs a lot more.
Yeah, then it becomes 10% surcharge every year that you wait. Yeah. So then it's unaffordable when you find out you really wished you had it. So what I would suggest people to do is don't be hung up on Blue Cross. I mean, nothing wrong with Blue Cross, great plan, but there's 15 other plans that might be cheaper.
Yeah.
And if five of those other plans waive your deductible and waive your coinsurance once Medicare becomes primary, pick the cheapest one with the best prescription coverage. And that's going to solve your issue because you may save as much on premiums as you'll spend on Medicare Part B, and then you have coverage for the future. You can always switch federal health plans later.
Right, every year. Okay, good enough. Need to take Lauren Larson is giving us the evil eye here. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM.
Federal career can last 30 years or more, and so can federal retirement. Tune in every Monday at 10:05 a.m. to get the information you need to plan your course for financial security, solid benefits, and optimum health care. 100% focused on the federal employee. For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, has the answers to your career retirement planning questions. Listen to For Your Benefit, sponsored by WEPA, Mondays at 10:05 a.m. on Federal News Radio 1500 a.m. for topics and ideas that could change your future. For free information, visit NITPINC.com and WAEPA.org.
Danger Zone. New, tough, direct, uncompromising. Saturday morning, 7 a.m., 1500 on your AM dial. Insider information on the trouble spots of the emerging world. India, Egypt, Morocco, and their crowded regions. From retired U.S. Marine Special Forces Operator Colonel Bill Cowan and me, retired U.S. Ambassador Dick Carlson. Nothing else like it on radio or TV. Danger Zone, Saturday morning, 7 a.m. on 1500 AM.
Weekends were made for football in Annapolis. Join the Mids as they take on VMI Saturday, October 11th at 3:30 p.m., presented by USAA. Another exciting season is underway, and you won't want to miss game day, the Navy way. To secure your best seats, call the Navy ticket office today at 1-800-US-4-NAVY or go to NavySports.com. Again, that's 1-800-US-4-NAVY or go to NavySports.com. 2014 Navy football, game day, the Navy way.
Hi, everybody. It's David and Nikki Nellis with Foodie and the Beast, the D.C. area's one and only food and wine variety show.
This Sunday, we'll be joined by Mark Furstenberg. You know him from his famous breads at Bread First, and he's bringing with him the elusive Frank Ruda. They're going to be cooking together. And also, Capital Teas is coming in. They're going to soothe us with some delicious teas.
That's Foodie and the Beast this Sunday at 11, right here on 1500 AM.
Everything you do is traceable back to your IP address. If you post a comment or you post anything to the blog, no matter what you put down as your username when you're posting it, it can still go right back to your IP address. So if anybody wanted to track you down, they could go into the logs, they could see that IP address, they could figure out exactly where you were by going back to your IP address. Once you post something on the web, it's going to be there forever.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM. Shared Services and Government offer the opportunity to assess key business needs of agencies who use the collected information to develop a standard, repeatable, and less costly way to deliver quality, timely services. Join FC of Bethesda on October 23rd at the Bethesda North Marriott to discuss shared services, the technology required to implement them, and the strategic sourcing and change management strategies required to make them successful. Register today at fcofbethesda.org.
Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with Tammy Flanagan. She is a benefits expert with the National Institutes of Transition Planning, columnist for Government Executive, and the inventor of the best date to retire, which we dine off of a lot now. It's very useful, as you can tell by the questions we've been getting. We just swamped with emails here, so we're going to go directly to it. Here's one from Alexis, and she said she wants to retire in January 2015, but stuck on deciding what to do about the survivor benefit. When I retire, I'll have 33 years under CSRS. My husband is under FERS and plans to retire in 2 years at age 60. We're each covered by our own health and life insurance. A lot of people I've spoken with say the only reason to select your survivor benefit is for the insurance coverage, that's health insurance coverage, and then I should not select it as this will decrease my annuity. And she wants to know, is there a calculator? What should she do?
Yeah, I know. The big concern is health insurance. And in this family's case, they're both federal employees. They're both going to retire from federal service. So they're not going to have to worry about health insurance. Whether he carries it, she carries it, they can both have it. That's fine. The big issue is, should I elect a survivor benefit for my husband in case I die first and my retirement stops?
Mm-hmm.
You know, with 33 years under CSRS, let's say her high threes, I have no idea, but let's say it's $100,000. That retirement's going to be worth over $60,000 a year. And if you die, that $60,000 stops coming in. So the survivor benefit can provide over half of that to be continued to be paid to her husband, who might be living on that money while he's by himself, as much as they're living on it together. You know, regardless of the fact he has his own retirement, you get used to living on two incomes,
yeah,
and one stops, especially the bigger one stops,
yeah,
you might have a big problem. So I would say, think about, what if I die first? Think of it as life insurance,
because okay,
that's really what it is.
Okay. Here's one from Claire Ann. It would be really beneficial to have a good and detailed explanation available to show all options. I believe the snippets are great, but we need to go into detail. What's the best plan of action in such instances? Consideration for individuals who may plan on retiring overseas. What are the advantages and disadvantages with regard to reciprocal country agreements?
Yeah.
You know, that's a tough one, and I think she really should go to the National Active and Retired Federal Employees. They probably know more about this, and also they know how many members they have in foreign countries and how many retired Americans are living in foreign countries. There's a huge number in the Philippines.
Yeah, there's
of all
tens
places.
Of thousands of federal retirees,
right,
overseas, so that's
and many,
not uncommon.
Many, many, obviously, in Mexico, Costa Rica, places like that.
Yeah.
And I think the former president of Latvia is a NARF member and a federal retiree, because although he worked in the U.S. for the federal government, when he retired, he went back home and Latvia was suddenly free and he became president.
Well, I think a couple of things I'd add to that is that, number one, overseas is not unusual for federal employees to work.
Yeah.
So many of our health plans serve worldwide. You know, Blue Cross has offices overseas. So I would pick a big national plan that has those offices overseas so that it's recognized no matter where you go. And most people who live overseas in retirement still keep a U.S. bank, have their direct deposits go to the U.S. bank, and then they can just do, you know, payouts,
right,
from
and
that
course,
account.
The Foreign Service Association has a health plan.
Yeah,
too,
as long as you move to a country friendly with the U.S., you shouldn't have any trouble. And I think you don't really want to move to one that's not friendly.
Right. Okay, here's one from Lynette. When I retire, I'll take the reduction to get my spouse an annuity for when he needs it. Once he dies, what happens to that portion that he was receiving? Can my children are over 21, get it from the estate, or is it a done deal? Go on. Hope you understand my question.
Yeah. Again, another concern about the value of, you know, lost survivor benefits. You know, number one, when you take the reduction to your retirement to provide a survivor benefit, it's a 10% reduction, so it's expensive. If your spouse dies first, that reduction stops. In other words, you stop paying for the life insurance. Now, if you die first and your spouse gets it, it's to provide for them. When they're gone, it ends. It doesn't go on to children. It doesn't go on to your sister. It just ends. So if your spouse only outlives you by 6 months, it served its purpose.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, I think this is a case where federal workers don't know how lucky they are in some cases, because in the private sector, if you take a spousal reduction like that and the spouse dies, they send you a sympathy card, but they don't change the deductions.
Right. It's a permanent reduction.
Yeah. So here's one from...
I guess to get your money's worth, remarry a younger person.
Exactly. Yeah. There's a plan. Maria says, I've met the five-year rule for FEHBP, so I could carry it into retirement and add my spouse before retiring. My spouse is retired from the private sector, has an excellent health plan covering us both, so I'm enrolled in a low-cost self-only plan. Is there a low-cost national plan you could recommend for both of us to enroll in just in case his insurance is no longer available? that's a really good question. And there's the issue, too, of if she dies, she's the Fed, she dies with a self-only plan, I assume he's not covered, correct?
Yeah, that's true. You have to die in a family plan, which is kind of hard to plan for.
Yeah.
I mean, some of these answers to questions kind of sound glib, but it's the truth. You have to think about that if I'm carrying self-only coverage in the hopes that later on I can switch to family, I'm taking the risk
if I
die in self-only, I'm out of luck.
So she should probably, take the lowest cost family plan, federal health plan,
Stay safe. Yeah, and just look down the list, because those new premiums are now published on OPM's website. So if you go to opm.gov and then click on insurance, there's a link to insurance and then healthcare, and you'll see the 2015 premiums. And some actually have gone down, believe it or not, but the more average premium increase has gone up. So
right,
you'll see some rates different for next
Jason
year.
Miller on our staff reported on this morning, and he pointed out that while the premiums are going up, it depends on whose average you use, whether you use OPMs or the statistical average. But
that's right.
That in any case, Blue Cross Blue Shield, which has 6 out of every 10 federal workers and retirees, most retirees are in it, it's going up a little more than that. Not considerably more, but enough that people should shop around.
Yeah, I'd say the least expensive, looking at quick glance, is Letter Carrier's Value Plan is under $100 a month for self only, and that's the only one that's under $100 a month on the list of national plans.
That would be a good insurance, so that you can have insurance plan, wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
Here's one from Andrea. It says, I'm under CSRS with 35 years as of October 9th. Eligible to retire with plans to leave end of November 1st or December 2015. I normally take 3 weeks off at Christmas for the holidays, so I figured that leaving before the holidays, I'd get 192 plus the 240 carryover hours of annual leave. A friend said I should take my normal leave and then retire the 1st of January 2016. Your thoughts on this? Boy, I'm glad you're here.
Yeah. This is like a jigsaw puzzle, right? We'd have to sit down and put all the pieces together for this. What I'd want to do is calculate how much more her retirement would be by staying the extra month or two. It looks like she's thinking about November 1st or December 1st or maybe January 1st. So she's got a 3-month window there. So I'd probably do the calculation of the extra service added to her retirement. The fact that she's going to take those 3 weeks off of leave is okay, because she's still going to have more leave. She's got the 240 plus, she's going to have another 100 plus hours. And cashing that in 2015 is going to probably be better tax-wise, assuming she doesn't start a second career. And I know it's not a big pay increase, but even with a 1% pay increase, if you leave in January, a lot of that will be paid at the 1% higher pay rate.
Okay, yes,
so
true.
So without doing
every
the numbers, I'd probably still lean, I'd agree with her friend, probably lean towards the end of the year.
Okay.
January 2nd.
And I don't know if you want to answer the second part of it. It looks pretty common. It's about setting up an annuity. And I do know that many financial planners don't recommend the annuity option in the TSP.
Well,
they say,
Exactly. Yeah. I think we hear that all the time. We don't recommend the annuity. But why? What's wrong with the annuity? Well, the reason why that is because when you take part of your TSP money and you convert it to a TSP annuity, it leaves your thrift.
Yeah.
So it's no longer in the G fund, the C fund, the S fund. It now is with MetLife, because MetLife holds the contract for the annuity. So when they get your money, they're not giving it back other than at a monthly rate.
Right.
And so the goal is to live long enough to get back all your money, or hopefully get back more than you gave them, which there's no guarantees. And if you die early, you lose.
Yeah.
So you have to consider the value of that sense of
and
security.
The rate on the annuities now is not very good.
It's a low rate on the interest rate. Yeah. So there are reasons to kind of really think twice before you take that sense of security and give up the control of your money.
Okay, here's one. He said it's going to be in a meeting today. Can't listen to the show. But by the way, the shows are archived on our homepage, so anybody can listen anytime they want to on their home computer or at work if they'll let you. Mm-hmm. He says, my agency's offered a voluntary early retirement option that would require setting a retirement date in January 2015 if selected. At the time, I'll be 55, 27 years, 4 months service. I'll receive my first annuity payment on 1 March. Understand that I will not receive my first FERS supplement payment until I turn 56. I was born in 1959. My personnel specialist indicates that I cannot draw money on my TSP account without incurring a 10% penalty until I reach age 59 and a half. Mm-hmm. Documents accessed at the TSP and IRS websites indicate that if you're age 55 or older in the year you separate or retire, the 10% early withdrawal penalty does not apply. Wish Bob Lyons was here.
Yeah, but that's true, because I quote from that publication all the time, and Bob has confirmed it, that he's right. You know, if he retires in the year that he turns 55, and it sounds like he'll be over 55, he'll be exempt from the 10% penalty. So he could start to take immediate withdrawals, a monthly payment if he wants to, or a lump sum distribution from his TSP account. Now, he'll have to pay tax on it, but not the 10% penalty tax. You know, I'm more concerned about the fact he's leaving with 27 years of service, because it's not going to be a huge retirement. So unless he's planning on a second career, make sure he can afford to make this choice. You know, who knows what else he has? He might have $1 million in the bank, but make sure that's an affordable decision.
Okay. Here's one from John. He says he can't listen today, so we'll be able to listen later, but he may not know that. But he said, I've always kept a 5-year rule in mind and want to keep my federal health insurance plan both before and after retirement. My husband, also a Fed, always carried family coverage, and it was paid from his retirement once he retired. Since his death, the insurance is paid from my survivor annuity. I therefore don't have health insurance coming out of my federal salary. I'm now 65, and there's a big penalty if I don't sign up for Medicare. I guess she means Medicare Part B, unless I'm covered by federal group policy, which I am. But it appears the group policy through retirement doesn't count for that purpose. To avoid the Medicare penalty, do I have to start paying for the same policy I have now for my paycheck instead of survivor annuity? I'm having trouble finding anyone who can figure this out.
Yeah, she's on the right track. Yeah, there is an exception to the 10% penalty that we just mentioned a few minutes ago. And that is if you are covered by health insurance through a paycheck.
Okay.
So if her health insurance starts coming out of her salary rather than out of the survivor benefit, she can delay Part B enrollment without penalty for as long as she continues to work.
Okay.
And I would suggest doing that, especially if she's in good health.
Okay. Lauren wants us to take a break here. We'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM.
And now it's time for another FedGuard Factor, career essentials for federal employees.
You insure your house, you insure your car. Why wouldn't you want those same protections and indemnifications for your career? In today's federal workplace, unfounded complaints and charges are more and more common. Legal fees can wind up in the tens or even hundreds of thousands of dollars. A FedGuard policy can cover you for a few hundred dollars a year. That's less than 1 hour of billing that any good lawyer would charge in such cases.
Learn more at FedGuard.com. That's FedGuard.com.
It's another early morning in Maria's neighborhood, and Maria's just now getting home after a long night. During the past 12 hours, she was involved in 4 accidents. What's her deal? Maria spent the night on duty at her local Montgomery County Volunteer Fire Department protecting her neighbors and family. Are you willing to lose some sleep in order to make a difference? Learn more at joinfirerescue.com. That's joinfirerescue.com.
Are you protected from today's cyber threats? Does your agency have the tools to identify vulnerabilities and manage them over the full cybersecurity lifecycle? Tune in for an in-depth conversation with industry experts Mary Mayanato and Bill Kazor of SAIC, followed immediately by a live online chat to get your questions answered on how to manage the cybersecurity lifecycle and stay ahead of threats. Register today at federalnewsradio.com/cyberthreat and listen in Wednesday, October 15th at 2:30 p.m. Sponsored by SAIC, Smart Solutions for a Complex World.
Here's Sylvia Burns, CIO, Department of the Interior, on the Government Perspectives on Mobility and the Cloud panel discussion, sponsored by Microsoft.
Our game plan is ultimately to get them into 6 core data centers that we have within the Department of the Interior, and then alternatively have things move to the cloud. So it's either we go to a kind of a private cloud hosted solution, or we go to our 6 internal core data centers.
To listen to the whole program, log on to federalnewsradio.com/onecloud.
Modernize your mobile workforce by connecting your agency with cost-effective, open, and agile tools optimized for the cloud. Microsoft Azure supports a large and growing number of open-source applications, frameworks, and languages to support the Open Government Partnership today. Microsoft understands that developers want to use the tools that best fit their experience, skills, and application requirements, and their goal is to enable that choice. Visit Microsoft.com/Azure today. That's Microsoft.com/AZURE.
What makes Train different, better, unstoppable? The ClimaTough compressor, for one. Visit trainsearch.com to locate an independent Train comfort specialist dealer near you and learn more.
Come to the National Academy of Public Administration annual meeting Thursday, November 13th at the DoubleTree in Crystal City. This year's event, Public Administration 2025, How Will Government Adapt?, brings together federal, state, local, and international leaders to find solutions to the greatest challenges facing our nation's governments. The event features an impressive array of speakers from across government, including OPM Director Catherine Archuleta and officials from executive and legislative branch agencies. For more information and to register, visit napawash.org.
Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, talking with Tammy Flanagan from the National Institutes of Transition Planning. And Tammy is the inventor of a number of things to do with federal retirement and benefits, and specifically the Best Day to Retire, which we feast off of all year. And some really good questions. I just handed one over to Tammy. It's from somebody, and it looks like he's talking about losing money or going broke if he retires.
Well, actually, it's from Peter, and he's under FERS, and he has reached the full Social Security retirement age. And what that means to anybody who's at 66 right now, which would be the current full retirement age, is that you can start claiming your Social Security benefit even though you might continue to work. So that income can start coming in. And then he goes on to say, because of my age, I can also contribute the full contribution to the TSP, which is the $17,500 plus the $5,500 catch-up. And his wife can also put money into her IRA. So it says people seem to retire at the end of the year or the very beginning of the year, but it appears to me if you retire on those dates, you give up these tax-free dollars that you could be putting in your thrift. So that has something to be said for a mid-year retirement. Bob talks about this. Bob Lyons talks about this when he talks about tax planning, that if you retire in May or June, if you're not all about saving up the annual leave, you can spend those first 5 or 6 months of the year maxing out your TSP and lowering your taxable income one last time before you go into retirement. So, yeah, there's something to be said for that, and that should be another consideration.
Good question. This is two-part here. I'm going to leave the last one because it's kind of ancient history. It's from Jeff, and he says, I'm considering retiring from civil service retirement system at the end of the year. Nominally, January 2nd looks like the best day to retire. Not necessarily, but get the holiday, 208 use it or lose payout, 208 hours of annual leave, the spouse's benefit Social Security check for December 2014. My understanding is that I must work on the last day of employment. So my question is, here's a hopeful one. What happens if the Secretary of Labor, his agency, says, hey, you've all worked hard, take the day off after New Year's? I know it's slim chance of that. Does that mean I must retire effective at the close of December 31, 2014? I certainly don't want to go until January 5th, 2015 and lose the CSRS check for January, nor work till the end of the month and lose 208 hours of annual leave on January 11th. So did he sort of answer his own question?
Well, yes. Well, I think he doesn't know this, but stay till January 2nd, regardless of what happens with the day off. Because you can retire on your day off. You can retire on a Saturday, Sunday. That's just your effective date of retirement. Your service will be computed through that date. So even though they give you the day off, you still get paid for that day. So that's nice. You don't have to come to work and you're going to be retired. So stay with January 2nd.
Right. And in recent years, for what it's worth, it's not the Secretary of Labor, it's the president. But in recent years, they have occasionally given them the day before or after Christmas off, but that rarely have they given the day before or after New Year's Day.
Yeah, that's true. That's by that time, we're over the holidays.
Gone with the wind. Yeah,
that's right.
All good spirits are.
Although this year it's on a Friday, so you never know.
Could, could be. Can you provide any preferred retirement dates for calendar year 2015, specifically the end of a quarter, such as March 31, June 30, September 30th, December 31st. And this is like numerology, a Ouija board on steroids.
I know, I get my crystal ball. This is funny. I did write a column on the best dates for 2015. And when I do that on GovExec, I post the whole calendar. So you can look at that and see those dates. But really what you're looking at, if you're under FERS, now this employee doesn't say, do they? I think it doesn't say FERS or SERS. But under FERS, you generally want to start with the last day of the month. I don't care if it's the last day of March or June or whatever month you're looking at, because that means your retirement will start the next day and you'll get paid your salary for the whole month. If you're under CSRS, you have this three-day grace period that it's worth taking advantage of if it'll get you to the end of the week or get you a few more days of salary or maybe get you another leave accrual. So when you're looking at the calendar, you know, for instance, next year, April 30th is a Thursday and May 1st is a Friday. It's the end of the leave period. So if I was a CSRS employee and wanted to go out the end of April, I'd probably pick May 1st. If I was a FERS employee, I'd probably stay with April 30th.
Okay, it really does make a difference.
Yeah, sure does.
Okay, here's one from Marcia, and this is an interesting one because I know a lot of people think about this. She said, I'm CSRS offset. I understand that mean that my civil service pension will be offset by whatever I get from Social Security. If the Social Security well should run dry some years after I retire, will I get 100% of my CSRS pension? I mean, my answer to her, not to be flippant, is if Social Security goes bust, we're probably going to be dealing in barter.
That's right. We have more to worry about than your civil service retirement. But the fact of the matter is, and that was protected in the law when civil service offset was designed, to say that if something happened where you weren't going to get Social Security, you would continue getting your civil service.
Okay.
So,
but,
yeah, she would.
She would. Would she get the full the offset?
The same as if she hadn't been under offset.
Not a silly question
at
all.
No, it's not.
Well, here's one from Paula. Can you provide a list of deductions that you won't have to pay from your retirement check that's being deducted now as an active employee?
Yeah, because that's really what it boils down to. Because the gross amount, you know, sounds like a really great number, but then you got to figure out what's left. You know, you have deductions in retirement just like you have deductions out of your paycheck. So in retirement, the only withholdings are going to be for insurance and federal income tax and maybe state income tax. So state depends on where you live.
Okay.
As far as reductions to your retirement, those are the more important ones. What about survivor benefits? You know, a lot of people were asking about that reduction for survivor benefits. And the nice thing is when you get your retirement estimated, ask your agency for an estimate, it should show you any possible reductions for survivor benefits, unpaid deposits, age reductions. And then it should show you your withholdings. The only thing not shown is taxes.
And as you pointed out, if you're having 22.5 taken out for the TSP and suddenly it's not being taken out, it's a lot of money.
Yeah.
Tammy, thank you so much for being with us. Lauren Larson's given us the hook. And Andy Medici from Federal Times is going to come up in a minute here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Yeah.
Here's Major General Al Acock, Director of Operations in the Office of the Assistant Chief of Staff for Installation Management at the Department of the Army, on the American Readiness, Renewable Power and Efficiency Technologies panel discussion sponsored by Honeywell.
We've already met our federal goals for that 7 years in advance. We have been aggressively converting petroleum-based vehicles into alternative fuel vehicles and hybrid vehicles to the point where we've already met that goal.
To listen to the whole program, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
Nearly 50% of Honeywell's products deliver energy efficiency benefits across multiple business sectors. By adopting Honeywell products, the U.S. alone could reduce energy consumption by 25%. From Honeywell's advanced turbine engines providing greater range for missions to upgrades to federal facilities and campuses, improving both energy efficiency and security, to their drop-in biofuels. Learn how Honeywell is helping the world meet its energy challenges. Visit Honeywell.com.
Johns Hopkins Engineering delivers the academic reputation you want and the flexibility you need with part-time master's degrees and certificates in 20 disciplines and classes available online and in person. Learn more at this week's online information sessions for computer science, cybersecurity, information systems engineering, and mechanical engineering. And next week, check out systems engineering, space systems engineering, and civil engineering. RSVP to ep.jhu.edu. That's ep.jhu.edu.
The internet is part of everyone's life every day. However, being constantly connected brings increased risk. No country, industry, community, or individual is immune to cyber risks. October marks the 11th National Cybersecurity Awareness Month. Tune in October 16th at 10 a.m. We'll be speaking with current and retired federal executives and industry experts about the strides we're making as a nation to protect our citizens, infrastructure, and economy. That's Thursday, October 16th, 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., sponsored by BAE Systems.
Are you protected from today's cyber threats? Does your agency have the tools to identify vulnerabilities and manage them over the full cybersecurity lifecycle? Tune in for an in-depth conversation with industry experts Mary Mayanato and Bill Kazor of SAIC, followed immediately by a live online chat to get your questions answered on how to manage the cybersecurity lifecycle and stay ahead of threats. Register today at federalnewsradio.com/cyberthreat and listen in Wednesday, October 15th at 2:30 p.m. Sponsored by SAIC, Smart Solutions for a Complex World. Here's Mary Givens, Deputy Director for Office of Information Services, NRC, on the Federal Executive Forum on Defense Cloud Computing, Progress and Best Practices, sponsored by Schneider Electric.
Across the government, I think it's an opportunity for more standardization. And so hopefully we will, as government, get out of the business of trying to manage data centers. And finally, I think once security is worked out, that you'll see more and more in the public cloud for government agencies.
To listen to the whole program made possible by Trezor Media Group, log on to Federal News Radio.
Struggling to meet your data center consolidation and sustainability goals? Look to Schneider Electric. From assessments, planning, and infrastructure improvements to funding vehicles to overcome capital shortfalls, Schneider Electric offers the industry's leading expertise that you need to create more efficient, available data centers. With their future-minded solutions, you'll realize lower lifecycle costs, enhanced physical security, and a smaller building footprint. That's Schneider-Electric.us.
Calling all government, military, and defense industry executives, the Association of the United States Army invites you to attend its 60th annual meeting and exposition, October 13th through the 15th, at the Walter E. Washington Convention Center.
More than 400 exhibitors from around the world will display the latest defense technology, and forums will be held for soldiers, family members, government, defense, civilians, and industry executives.
Join over 28,000 people in this unique professional development defense forum.
Admission is free, but limited to qualified persons. Visit AUSAannualmeeting.org.
Federal News Radio's Jared Serbu is on Twitter. Follow him at JSerbuWFED for the latest news about the Defense Department and defense contracting at JSerbuWFED.
Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. We just had a wonderful session with Tammy Flanagan from National Institutes of Transition Planning about best dates and all manner of things. And one question we didn't get to, Tammy's going to stick around. We'll be talking with Andy Medici, senior writer with the Federal Times. Andy, are you with us?
It's good to be here, Mark.
Good to have you get back in the saddle here. This is one for you, me, and Tammy from Linda. And she said, I'm not a federal employee. I'm a contractor, age 57. I have no retirement plan. Only Social Security in my 401k. What do I do for retirement at this point? And my answer, again, not to be flippant, is get a government job.
Well, I mean, you know, people really like the government job for its security in retirement. And I think that's been one of its bigger draws in the last 10 or 15 years. You know, there have not been as many pay raises. But as I heard from the rest of your conversation, federal employees do have options. And as you were both saying earlier, you know, there are a lot of people who, while they have questions about retirement, seem to have some options and some plans to be able to do so.
Well, I noticed a number of major employers, including the Washington Post, have dropped their pension plan. Yeah. There's no retirement for these people, and that's the that's the norm rather than being unusual in the private sector. So to me, when they talk about people being unhappy with government service, it looks like a very good employer compared to everybody else.
Well, I think the number of private sector employers with defined benefit plans is below, I want to say below 5% now, maybe 4%.
Wow.
So the federal government, you know, it does have that. And for a lot of people, that's very attractive. And I'm sorry, but for people in the private sector, for example, I have 401k and Social Security, and that's what I'm planning to use when I go into retirement as well.
Yeah, it is unusual in the private sector to have a defined benefit where they promise you. Hey, I wanted to ask both of you this. The health insurance premiums just came out. You can get them on our homepage. I know you can get them at Federal Times, or you can go to opm.gov and get them. But looking at these different health plans, and the, you know, as Tammy said, some are going up more than others. I only see one or two that are they're cutting the premium. That's not much. But the fact that Congress left the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program this year, and I would think that's not a good thing for federal workers, because the members of the House and the Senate and many congressional staffers now, they don't have a dog in this fight anymore.
Well,
what do you think?
I think that is a concern. You know, you want the program. That's why Social Security is so popular, is that everyone gets it. And I think that when you have people leave a program, but on the other hand, the FEHB is so large and it negotiates pretty well for federal employees that I think it will be hard to affect, even if members of Congress themselves are no longer in it.
Well, what I was thinking was they have defended the federal payment to it, you know, the 72% of the premium for non-postal workers and more than that for postals. And every year, even though premiums go up, the share is remains the same. But I just wonder if there might be more pressure on that to save the government money by making it a 50-50 split, and you won't have members of Congress there to champion it.
I mean, that is a concern. I'm not sure if Congress will be able to do that. They've had ideas to do that in the past. They haven't gotten as far as they have been. And by and large, this Congress will end. You'll have new members, new ideas in the next Congress. So we'll have to see. It's always a concern, but I don't think at this point it's very likely to happen.
I had a high-ranking official of the old Civil Service Commission and OPM who knew the retirement program intimately, had been involved in it for 2 decades, maybe more, and he said once, long after he retired, that there had not been a single retirement law, not a single bill that passed Congress that didn't, in addition to everything else it did, benefit some member of Congress or some congressional staffer.
Yeah, I mean, I'd have to agree with that. That's the way Congress works, or sometimes doesn't work at all, if we've been watching the last couple of years. And when it comes to federal retirement system, there are millions and millions of people involved with it, with the health insurance, with the annuities, and it would be very hard for Congress to affect change, and there'd have to be a lot in it for them to do so.
Good. Andy, what are you working on now?
Well, besides the federal employee health benefits plan, I wrote a story recently about federal workers' compensation programs, and they've been hanging around $3 billion for a while now, but some agencies are able to control them, and some, like we've talked about before, the Postal Service are really having a hard time with those rising costs.
Yeah, and the Postal Service, turns out, is a very dangerous place to work, isn't it?
Yeah, the number of postal employees, 18, died in 2013 on the job, mostly from transportation-related accidents, but there have been violent attacks on postal employees, specifically mail carriers. And it's one of those jobs that comes with it a risk when you deliver to every address in the United States.
Well, a policeman will tell you, a career policeman, that the most dangerous aspect of their job often is being in a cruiser six, seven, 8 hours a day, even more so than the gunplay. And when you consider postal workers, they're in a Jeep-like vehicle with right-hand drive, you know, sometimes going the wrong direction, can be a very risky business.
And, you know, even when a driver does everything right, you have to count on all the other drivers doing everything right. And
yeah.
In that case, you know, it can be impossible to avoid some of those accidents. And some of those accidents, unfortunately, result in the deaths of federal employees.
And I know you've been following the combined federal campaign. It did not do so well last year, correct?
A record low. It hadn't done as badly since 1998. I think the total was around $208 million, which was down about 20% from the previous year. And mostly, you know, a lot of people attribute that to the shutdown, but there have been gradual declines in CFC contributions over the last few years.
Well, I read your story, and I wondered at the time most people go on payroll deduction, I assume, and they say take out $10 a week from my biweekly check and give it to whatever. in a situation like the government shutdown, could they stop that payroll deduction? And did, is that one of the reasons that the amount of money declined?
Well, there wasn't just the payroll deduction. I think during the time when federal employees aren't paid, they don't do it. But then when they get that other paycheck, they have to take out an extra amount for things that they should have withheld. So I'm not sure how much it affected that. It's just that federal
the overall
atmosphere. Federal employees, you know, more and more, they got 3 years of pay freezes and then a 1% pay raise. They had the shutdown, and even during that year, there were furloughs. And I think for a lot of federal employees, they were concerned, and rightly so, worried about their financial future. And it's harder to give in that kind of environment. And I think a lot of younger federal employees are less likely to join. There's a lot of giving still going on, but I don't know how much of it's being done through the CFC anymore.
Right. After 3 years of a pay freeze and 2 years where they're going to get back-to-back 1%ers, that's not much of an incentive. I was thinking, as you said that, this shows the absurdity and the chaos created by having a shutdown that's not needed. It's just something that, that both political parties are playing games with. You shut down the government for 16 days. People don't get paid. They go to FEA to get emergency loans. Their combined federal campaign contributions stop during that period. And then when they come back to work, Congress says, oh, well, we'll pay them anyhow. So I think the chaos and the turmoil that creates is kind of mind-boggling.
You know, I think we're going to see the ripple effects from it, you know, even years from now in federal employees who had to suffer through it and in members of Congress who helped initiate it. You know, those we were still talking about the previous shutdown during the Clinton years, and that's still fresh in a lot of people's minds, and you have this layered on top of it. And I think a lot of federal employees are going to remember that down the road when it comes time for Congress to keep renewing appropriations legislation.
I was talking to a retiring member of Congress, and he said that a lot of his colleagues weren't there for the Clinton-Newt Gingrich shutdown. I think it was winter of 95, 96. And so they literally don't remember it. To them, it was, or they heard about it, but they didn't go through it. And he said it's almost as if we have to have this kind of bloodletting every 10 or 20 years. You know, a new generation comes in, and we have to start doing this all over again.
You know, I think in many cases that's correct. You had a large number of new congressmen in 2010 and 2012. And they didn't remember, or if they read news accounts from that time, you know, they thought they could do things differently. And as it always turns out, is the federal government, when it shuts down, or even partially shuts down, as people want to say, it hurts a lot of people and it affects a lot of people. And sometimes it's even hard to see how it's affecting people until we're looking back on it, you know, nearly a year later, talking about, you know, the CFC or about contracts that just came out or changes that to policy just came out because they were delayed so long.
Yeah, and a guy like Newt Gingrich, who was considered to be a presidential contender, was knocked out because of that. Look, Andy, Lauren Larson is giving us the signal. Thank you, Tammy. Thank you, Andy. We'll see everybody here next week. Remember, we're archived on our homepage. It'll be up today so you can listen to the show. We'll see you next Wednesday. Have a good week.